Hi everyone, Dr. Tiffany Kaplan here from Kaplan Health Institute. And today I have with me Michael Collins, author of The Last Sugar Resort Detox Guide. This is such an important topic, I think, that everybody can benefit from because let's face it, sugar is a very addictive substance. And many people, myself included, have struggled with it. And we know how detrimental it is to our health. So I'm excited to introduce you to Michael Collins, founder of SugarAddiction.com and board chairman of Food Addiction Institute. He has been completely sugar-free for many years, and he's worked closely with others to help them reclaim their lives ravaged by this addictive product. He's raised two sugar-free children, which I think is amazing. And his book, which is rated number one in healthy living on Amazon, is available to download for free. So definitely check that out. Mike, first of all, I know a lot of us that get involved in health have our own stories, have gone through our own health journeys, and I'd love to just kind of hear about how did you come into doing what you're doing and start looking at sugar addiction?
Okay. Well, thanks for having me, first of all. I really appreciate it. I know you guys are a friend of ours who cooked us up, so you guys are doing great work, and I'm honored to be here. But you know, I think I was a regular kid. I mean, I started just like everybody else. My mom was a sugar junkie. I mean, my favorite sugar junkie, and she had a stash. We all knew where it was. It wasn't a big secret, or she thought it was a big secret, but it wasn't. And, you know, we grew up in a time where we didn't have a lot of money, and we would make Kool-Aid with three times the sugar recipe. And if we didn't scrape a half an inch of sugar off the bottom of the bowl of the cereal, we didn't put too much, we didn't put enough sugar in. And we had unfettered access to that sugar bowl. It was weird. Like, they didn't even say anything. Like, I got that sugar bowl from the estate. You know, it's like, they didn't mind, you know, they just thought sugar was fine. You know, that was not a big deal. There's a great YouTube video on Eric Clapton and Ed Bradley of 60 Minutes. They're in his $7 million Antigua Treatment Center, right? And so Ed Bradley says to Eric Clapton, the great guitar player, so this addiction thing, this all started with heroin, right? He said, no, Ed, it started with sugar. And so he said, I used to eat bread and butter and sugar sandwiches, right? And we used to eat bread and butter and sugar sandwiches, brown sugar and bright white, you know, if there wasn't any food or lunch meat or peanut butter and jelly, we would have sugar on our sandwiches. So anyway, fast forward, I loved every kind of candy, ice cream, cookies, and I was the oldest, so I would go shopping. That was my treat to, you know, I get to pick one out to carry all the bags and everything. And it just progressed. And I didn't realize it was changing my state. You know, I didn't realize that it was affecting my dopamine. The science didn't either at that time, dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine, gabapentin. We didn't know that sugar was hitting those brain reward chemicals, right? So at 13 or 14, I ran into beer and pot and all these other things, right? And this is probably another podcast, but I need to tell you about it because, you know, most health folks come from a health coaching background or a diet background or a nutrition background. And I come from an addiction background. So that party lasted till I was about 28 years old and I got sober, right? And so what I found was my fellows in recovery weren't gaining the freshman 15 like in college. They were gaining the freshman 50. They were 50 pounds of pop on their body in less than 12 months, right? And they were, you know, having diabetes diagnosis and all this kind of stuff. And I started to research it. And I was kind of a healthy guy and an athlete a little bit when I was younger. And I came across a book called Sugar Blues. I don't know if you ever heard of it. Written by a guy named William Duffy. And Duffy was at a party one time. And he was putting two lumps of sugar in his coffee, right? And he heard from behind this voice. And the voice said, I wouldn't have that stuff in my house, let alone my body. And it was Gloria Swanson, the famous movie star, right? And so he ended up marrying Gloria Swanson. And they promoted this book in the late 70s and early 80s. And I read it, and somehow I just got it in my head. I love the history of how we got here, you know, how they would go from England with empty boats, go to Africa, pick up slaves, go to the Americas and the Caribbean to pick up sugar and rum and molasses, and then go back. And they grew an empire in 300 years, 200 years, that was much bigger than El Chapo ever dreamed of, on the backs of sugar and slaves. And I don't know, that just hit me somehow. And, you know, I went on to, like you said, I raised a couple of sugar-free kids because I just got into it. Somehow I talked my ex, you know, my wife at the time into that. And, you know, till they were six, they never had sugar. They didn't even know what it was. They used to play like they were building blocks in the grocery store. They didn't even know what the stuff was. And then, that, you know, for their whole childhood, they didn't have it. So I went on to have a regular business life. I mean, I was a business guy and, you know, that kind of thing. But about 10 years ago, I bought the domain sugaraddiction.com and realized that my kids had always said, "Dad, you need to write a book about this stuff." And so that's how, that's a podcast version. This is a short version. That'll probably bring up more questions than it answers, but that's how I got here.
Awesome. I know that my story getting into health, like you said, a lot of people, it's their, either their background in nutrition or something like that. I got into it because my health was failing. I was severely depressed and anxious, and turned out my gut was a mess. It was a wreck. I had a huge candida overgrowth, and all through all of that learning process of, you know, getting into functional medicine and looking at my body differently and my diet differently, realized that a part of my sugar addiction was, I mean, I love the sugar foods and they're addictive and we're going to talk about that, but also had that infection in my gut that was causing me to create that addiction, yeah. Like, you know, keep it going. And it's hard. Like, it's a vicious cycle that people get into with their health where, you know, it's easy to get addicted to these foods, but it creates so many problems and dependency on it. And it's, you know, how do you kind of help people that are struggling with that? Like, I can't get off the sugar, or they go like a day and then they're right back on to it. Like, where do you kind of start with people like that? Or what do you address? And I know you talk about that in your book, but just for people that haven't, you know, read
it. Yeah, no, it's a good question. And it's a, you know, it's a fair question in that, you know, this is a product or a service people need, but they don't want necessarily. they have these issues and they start and then they stop. And they, like you said, they start and they stop and they start and they stop. And what we find is we have to use every kind of, how should I put this gently? We have to cajole them into our vessel, which is the groups of our, you know, we have Facebook groups and Zoom meetings. We have all these kind of ways where people, we have to separate them from the tribe that it's the tribe that is the sad American, the standard American diet, sad. You know, we have to, they have to understand that right now, morally, ethically, legally, there's no problem giving this product to a one-year-old. Baby, no one would think twice about it. But there are what I call, you probably, me for sure, canaries in the coal mine, who are, they understand, they've done their research, they've tried, like you said, many numerous times, some for decades, they've tried to get off of this product and they couldn't. They were not able to alone. And information alone, for the first five or six, seven years of doing this, I gave the best information on the internet. It was, you know, the most advanced science. It was this. It still didn't help because they were, folks were, you know, they were outside of the norm. And, you know, they'd get a week or a month or, you know, they lose 20 pounds and people say, okay, put the record books away. It's okay. You can have it's your birthday, blah, blah, blah. And they would go right back to it. Stories of them, of folks going back to it, are just replete in our community where, you know, one sip slice. And I, you know, people always ask me the question, is it 100% abstinence? That's the first question. Do I have to do this for the rest of my life? They can't cognitively they can't make it compute that they will never celebrate with a wedding or a birthday or a death, anything where they're going to not be able to eat a sweet, you know? And, you know, I can't tell them that at the beginning. I have to let them get 30, 60, usually 90 days in. But once someone gets a true 90 days of abstinence from these products, the question is different. The answer is different because they've seen their skin clear. They've seen the weight drop off. They've seen the brain fog lift. They've seen the candida overgrowth cure. Their body is falling to a right-sized body. And then they ask themselves, what the hell was I thinking? You know, like, how could I have thought that, you know, anyway, so what I'm getting at is it's a gentle process to get them, to ease them into this until they get to the other side of some abstinence. There you go.
Yes. And the accountability, like you were mentioning in the beginning, that's so helpful. Like, needing to be in a group of people that are doing this together, and also changing your mindset of,
sure,
with, you know, the celebrations, you have to have that cake or that soda or whatever. It's, we're brainwashed to think that these things are normal and okay for us, and in moderation is fine. But I know when I cut off sugar because of everything that was going on with me, I had withdrawal. I felt terrible. And I tell people, it's normal to feel worse at the beginning because it is an addiction. Your body's going through withdrawal. It's,
yes,
you know, it's changing our biochemistry in our brain. Like you mentioned dopamine earlier, right? It's,
yeah,
there's actually chemical changes that happen with the sugar addiction.
Well, you're so right about the withdrawals, and people are, they don't give it any respect as a psychoactive drug, a drug of addiction, right? They don't really, and the science has now proved this out, so it's not any longer a mystery. But a lot of health, like I was saying, you're a little advanced for a health educator, because a lot of health educators come at it with the diet and the exercise, right? They like to say that, you know, and a lot of them were probably never sugar addicts, right? They were one of the third of people who are like people that can drink alcohol regularly. They can just have one and no worries. You know, they're not a canary in the coal mine. Their body, their biochemistry can handle it better. But about a third of folks cannot biochemically handle this, and you can't outrun that biochemistry. And it's that bridge that you need to cross, where if that's you, you know, I don't want to say sorry, but it's like you have to be not in denial and just accept that this is the reality of it. Believe me, and hundreds and probably now thousands of people that we've worked with, when they get to the other side, are so much happier that they're not involved in this cult of sugar that was created over 300 years. They're okay with it. You know, they're in a group or a tribe that accepts it and is kind of waiting for the tipping point where the science says, like right now, I can't definitively say that, you know, you cut yourself with a razor blade, you're going to bleed, or, you know, this is a diagnosis of cancer, right? But, you know, 5, 10, 15 years from now, they're going to be able to have diagnostic tools that say, when you ingest sugar, I'll tell you what happens. This is interesting because, and I'm sure you've probably heard of this, the entire world changes when continuous glucose monitors, the things that now take a prescription where you put a little patch on you and you can watch on your phone when you eat something, the how much your glucose goes up and down, right? When that's a non-invasive, and Google and Amazon are working on that, when it's a non-invasive thing that you can just put on your wrist like a Fitbit and you can watch it on your phone, then the world changes. Because people are still in a little bit of denial that they, because it doesn't seem to affect them that much. This takes 20 or 30 years to get the metabolic syndrome and the diabetes and the Alzheimer's, whatever you think it causes, heart disease, whatever we know it causes. But so it's a, again, I'm back to the gentle easing them in.
So. Yeah, I think that's going to be life-changing for so many people and for healthcare as a whole too, because it's, yeah, like you were saying, it takes years or decades for these problems under the surface to actually be, to show up on labs. Like let's say, yeah, with insulin resistance, right? That could be going on for 10 years before it shows up as diabetes. And most doctors are not checking insulin levels. Like it's just yeah, going unchecked as a whole.
Sure.
One thing that people are always just shocked in horror when I tell them, but the average American consumes like 100 pounds of sugar every year, right? It's crazy.
Well, closer to 150, but.
Wow.
Average of 17 teaspoons a day, 20 teaspoons a day. So that's average. So the figure, some are lower, some are average. But the, you know, the obese to the people that are ill, 30, 40 more. In teenagers, it's worse too. Like 40 teaspoons is no problem. It's the dose that makes the poison, right? It's like you take a little bit of heroin, you take a little bit of cocaine, you take a little alcohol. We're pounding like 150 pounds through our system. That's before flour. Now that's sugar, right?
Wow.
You don't have to think about the flour that's on top of that, you know, which is raising the glucose, right?
Yeah.
But I want to make a clarification that I think is part of our work and part of the, and I'll get into more of it as we progress, but for your listeners, I'm sure a lot of them know, but For the ones that don't, table sugar is half glucose and half fructose, right? And fructose is the natural sweetener in, theoretically, the natural sweetener in fruit and everything. But in table sugar, it's been reduced to a white powder or white granule. And all most of the diet, the wellness people are worried about the glucose and the diabetes and the insulin resistance and that kind of stuff. But the reason people can't quit is not the glucose, although it affects it and they're kind of wired together in your brain a little bit. It does affect your brain. It's the fructose that is the psychoactive component that it's banging on your dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine, GABA, even your oxytocin and your adrenals. And, you know, back in the old days, crab apples were like this big and they weren't very sweet. And we weren't supposed to have much fructose. The only place that fructose can be processed is in the liver, okay? There's no bodily function that requires fructose. There's nothing in nature that's poison that contains fructose. So we were attracted to it, A, to move the seeds around from the apples and the bananas. Bananas like was a little seed pod. You couldn't even eat it, right? And so it's the growth in the high fructose corn syrup and fructose in general is the reason you can't quit, because you're not attracted to something sweet. You're attracted to the dopamine hit that the neural pathway was grooved since you were a baby. Okay. So you're a baby and your mother hands you a cookie. You're not like, you start to think like you're crying and worried. Mom doesn't have time to spend a minute with you. So she hands you a cookie and tends you to the TV, right? And so you start to unconsciously relate worry, sugar, pain, sugar, hurt, sugar. And these neural pathways are then grooved. And then as you become an adult, you start to handle stress the same way, right? And it's just, it takes a little digging into to separate yourself and also to rewire those neural pathways that have been your go-to. You don't have to go take a walk. You don't have to go to yoga. You just have to reach for a cookie and the anxiety will lessen, the worry will lessen just for a little bit. And that's the pattern that we end up getting in. It sounds a little bit complex, but it's really quite simple. It really is. It's revolving around the that dopamine hit to make us feel a little bit better.
And then it's so inflammatory. I think that's like one of the biggest problems we see. We work with a lot of autoimmune patients, and it's something that kind of under the surface, when we talk about reversing autoimmunity, putting it into remission, we look at like the root causes of the problem. Inflammation is always the root, you know, of these. So we see like with the fructose causing liver issues, well, then that's going to affect hormones and detoxability of the body. And it just kind of like trickles into all these other underlying factors of what's contributing to the immune system doing what it's doing and the inflammation that's fueling the disease. And it's kind of crazy how it's all tied in together. But it casts a lot too. Is sugar addiction like a real thing? Because I get asked that a lot. Is it real or is it just in my head? Like it's, you know.
Yeah, no, it's before I answer that, I do want to tell the folks that fructose and sugar 2 and sugar causes fatty liver, and we now have fatty liver in children. This is an alcoholic's disease, right? Because they can't process it anywhere else. So just a little bit of a warning there. But I do get asked the same exact question, is sugar addiction a real thing, you know? And like I said, I think I said earlier, but we're the canaries in the coal mine. We're the folks who are... It's affecting us. We realize it. It affects our happiness, or you know, our sleep, or you know, whatever. And I don't know if it says on my little bio there, but I run a thing called the Quit Sugar Summit every year, and we've interviewed over 200 people, including Dr. Robert Lustig, and you know, people who are studying this and been made their career out of it, written books about it, right? And so I asked them point blank, is fructose a psychoactive drug? And he wasn't the only doctor I asked. And they all said yes. They have come in their research to believe that the fructose is somehow affecting the brain rewards, the nucleus accumbens, the brain reward systems in our brain, the serotonin and all the things that I've mentioned, and that obviously, again, a lot of them even come from health and research about things that you're talking about, autoimmune and cancer and this, that, and the other thing. Lewis Cantley from Cornell, cancer. It's like they're studying that. But what I study, and because of my background, I study the addictive nature. And I call myself a 12-step whisperer, an anthropologist. And for 40 years, there's been food addiction groups who have named sugar and flour as the substance that they cannot stop, that they have to go abstinent with. And they knew this anecdotally through trial and error, but they didn't know it scientifically. And now the science is proving that this much sugar, table sugar, which is half fructose, hitting the system daily on and on and on, is causing a physical biochemical addiction to the product. And that when you stop, you mention it, and you begin withdrawals. And it's kind of nasty, you know? Yeah, it's not heroin withdrawals. It's not bad alcohol withdrawals, but it is headaches, insomnia, aches and pains, literal depression, you're not now getting your dopamine hit. And so a lot of people can't make it through that 10 or 15 days, or some people it's a little longer even. And then it extends a little bit because you've been dealing with your emotions. Now there's the construct in substance use disorder that if you started using drugs or alcohol when you were 15, it's very, very common and well known that you stopped growing emotionally at that point because you were manipulating your emotions with these substances. Well, think about this as a baby manipulating all of these brain chemicals. And when you put someone who's ingested sugar next to someone who's ingested alcohol or cocaine into an MRI, the exact same places light up. It's not different. It's not like they're like, oh, the sugar's over here and the cocaine's over here. They're in the same place. The brightness in the MRI is the same. And it's the dose that makes the poison, right? So we're just never, ever without it in the standard American diet. We're always hitting our brain reward system with this product. Do we know how, people always say to me, well, I'm not going to rob a bank for sugar. I'm not going to, you know what I mean? And I just think that's short-sighted in a lot of ways. They're not looking at the whole picture of why we can't quit, why it's hard to stop, why it's hard to change. So the answer to the question is absolutely, positively, 100%, it's an actual real addiction and a real thing. I'll get a lot of hate mail, but I don't care.
Yeah. I know you mentioned like the dose really matters, and for different people the dose can be different too, right? Like
some absolutely.
Little bits here or there can just kind of get them back into it, and other people can handle some, like it's not always just, oh, you're eating 100 pounds of sugar or something.
Everybody's a little different.
Yeah. What advice do you have for somebody that's struggling to get off sugar? Like do you recommend people go completely cold turkey all at once? Do you have them wean off of it? Is it different person to person?
It is a little, and it does depend on the habit. Like if you've got a really big habit, you're a couple 100 pounds overweight, you've never known a life without a sugar, basically sugar product your whole life, it's going to be a little different, and it helps a little bit to wean down. But at the end of the day, what we find is that the day that you go 100% abstinent, almost irregardless of your habit, you're going to have the withdrawals. Now, some people's withdrawals are worse than others. People that have a good substitute, which is usually exercise, old athletes or people who have a practice of walking or yoga or weightlifting or something, they seem to fare a little bit better because they're working, they know how to manipulate their dopamine by exercise, right? And if people that don't have that practice have a little bit tougher time. But yeah, no, regardless of your habit, regardless of weaning down, you will have most people, once in a blue moon, somebody says they didn't have withdrawals, but I find that hard to believe, maybe because I've never had that experience. But you've got to, it doesn't matter. You're going to have those withdrawals that day you quit. Just a little different.
And I think it sometimes can be from the other foods that the person is also getting off of at the same time, because when you're cutting off the sugar, you're probably cutting out the processed foods that have the sugar in them, and maybe cutting back on like gluten and dairy and those other things that are corn, right, that are also kind of addictive as well. Yeah. So then you can have withdrawals off of those.
Yeah, they're blended together. They all wired together, fired together, you know, like Pavlov's dogs, like you're eating a lot of bread and no fructose in it, but you're jacking your glucose. Your body's starting to think, well, where's the fructose right behind it? You know, where's the ice cream? Where's the cake? You know, where? So yes. And then one of the things that we've been recently, not recently, it's been a while. I mean, I've known it a while, but it's hard to get this because people is the caffeine, you know, is folks are like, that's another thing that's wired together, fired together. You know, it's like chocolate and tea and coffee. It's always caffeine and sugar, caffeine, you know what I mean? And so, and I found, and we're starting a separate caffeine group too, because that seems to be like the sugar for sensitives. And I think that probably at least a third of the population qualify for that. That's hard to get up, you know what I mean? So it's like these chemicals, these substances that have hit the brain reward system are all tied together in some way. And sometimes you have to do it all at the same time, which is tough. It's really hard. I mean, I cannot emphasize that it's not a walk in the park, you know, it really is kind of difficult. And, you know, so that lends itself to the, is it a real addiction? Is it a real withdrawal?
Yes, very, very real. If you had to pick one thing that you think would move the needle forward for our health and living our best lives, what would that be?
You know, I probably get in trouble for this saying, but I'm beginning to believe it, that because of these, again, only anecdotal and only reported in our community, but so many things have been relieved by quitting flour and sugar and caffeine that I mean, all kind of autoimmune and getting off diabetes meds and getting off SSRIs. I mean, the list goes on. It's endless, right? And we're not doctors. We can't, you know, say this is going to happen. We can't predict it. We can't, you know, we don't have the peer-reviewed studies. But I personally believe, after working with thousands of flour, sugar, and caffeine addicts over, you know, more than a decade's time, and really intensively in the last 3 years, is I believe flour, sugar, and caffeine are the cause of 80%+ of all maladies known to man, physical and mental. I just believe that there is a certain minority or possibly majority, excuse me, of the population that biochemically, just because it took 300 years of evolution to put these things into our food system, that does not mean that the human body can correctly handle them, and that the evolution of disease parallels the evolution of these things as they entered and grew in prominence in our society. And when people kind of come to that realization and they start to understand that, these innocuous type, what we people consider innocuous that you can give to a baby, substances over time do innumerable damage, then, you know, the world changes. So what's the thing that can move the needle the most for you? I would venture, I call it a scratch test. Like if you were to go to an allergist, he would scratch you for pollen or ragweed or whatever and see if you're allergic to it, right? So the quest or the thing that you need to do, if you're willing to be adult about this, and I don't mean to be harsh, but if you're willing to look in the mirror and say, maybe the guy's not crazy, just give yourself 90 days without all those three things and see what happens, because your own body will tell you the answer. Yeah, it'll be tough for 30 days, but after that, you're going to see so many different things change. Anyway, I hope that was a sufficient answer. I know it's a little radical sounding today in 2020, but I don't think that in 100 years, they're going to say, you know, they used to give sugar to kids, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's going to happen as soon as the science catches up with some of the anecdotal, stuff that we're observing now.
Yeah, that's where change starts, is people start to understand and take action with that information, right? Because knowing it's not going to change anything, but when they start to take action and see the results and feel better, that's really where change is going to come into. Now, I have one other question too. What about sugar substitutes? Because then people think, oh, well, what about erythritol or stevia or monk fruit or those things? Like, what's your take on those substitutes for people that are trying to get off sugar?
Yeah, no, it's a good one. It's always a fair one. I get it all the time. They want wiggle room, right? And what they, you know, what folks need is that scratch test. They need the answer is, again, I go back to the wired together, fired together. That means the brain chemicals, right? It's like, again, Pavlov's dogs. Your body tastes sweet, and it says there's got to be more coming, and it starts to set up the cravings. And that's really what we need to get to the other side of, is the craving for this thing. And the craving is an all-encompassing mind, brain, stomach, you know, rah, I got to have this kind of thing. And we have to move away from sweetness, okay? Pretty soon, carrots will taste real sweet. Blueberries will taste like crazy sweet. Peppers, you know, kale, things will taste sweet to you after you readjust the, I know you know this, but in food engineering, in addiction engineering, they have something called the bliss point, where they're trying to engineer perfect food combinations for mouthfeel, salt, fat, and sugar, and they come to a bliss point, right? And they modify the product for that, the processed product. Well, once you eliminate all of these products, then your normal natural taste buds come back online. And again, blueberries taste sweet, and peppers taste, you know, different stuff that should taste sweet, right? So yeah, it's, I'm not a believer in those things. And I think that they cause more, they just delay the process, okay? They just keep your cravings coming and draw you back to the stuff.
Yeah, and then when you get that message, it's so clear. There we go. Okay, awesome. Well, thank you so much, Michael, for being here with me today. It's been amazing to be able to dive into this topic. I think it's something that so many people can be helped with, learning more about sugar addiction. And I definitely encourage people to get your book too. Or go to sugaraddiction.com, your website, and get
more. Yeah, you get the book at sugaraddiction.com.
Awesome.
Yeah, there's a download there.
Very cool. Thank you so much for being here, and enjoyed our conversation today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Keep up the good work you guys are doing. Appreciate it.
Awesome. You too. Thanks.